When the worm rose from the sands, it revealed a mouth large enough to swallow a spacecraft, ascending higher and higher, its maw opening wider as its flexible jaws spread like the petals of a flower. In an instant it engulfed the insignificant black speck of the thumper and all the explosives. Its crystal teeth shone like tiny sharp thorns spiraling down its bottomless gullet. From 300 meters away, Kine saw ridges of ancient skin, overlapping folds of armor that protected the creature in its passage beneath the ground. The worm gulped the booby-trapped bait and began to wallow into the sands again. Raban stood up with a demonic grin on his face and worked small transmitting controls. A hot breeze dusted his face, peppering his teeth with grains of sand. He pushed a button. A distant thunderclap sent a tremor through the desert. The sands shifted in tiny avalanches from the fingernail dunes. The sequenced bomb ripped through the internal channels of the worm, blasting open its gut and splitting its armored segments. As the dust cleared, Kynes saw the writhing, dying monstrosity that lay in a pool of disrupted sand, like a beached fur whale. "That thing's more than 200 meters long," Raban cried, taking in the extent of his kill. The guards cheered. Raban turned and pounded Kynes on the back with nearly enough strength to dislocate his shoulder. "Now there's a trophy, planetologist. I'm going to take this back to Giedi Prime with me." Almost unnoticed, Thekkar finally arrived, sweating and panting, hauling himself up to safety on the rocks. He looked behind him with mixed emotions at the faraway dead creature sprawled on the sands. Raban led the charge as the worm ceased its final writhing. The eager guards sprinted across the sands, shouting, cheering. Kynes, anxious now to see the amazing specimen up close, hurried along, stumbling as Harkonnen troops plowed a battered path ahead of him. Many minutes later, panting and hot, Kynes stood awestruck in front of the towering mass of the ancient worm. Its skin was scaled, covered with gravel, thick with abrasion-proof calluses. Yet between the segments that sagged open from the explosions, he saw pink, tender skin. The gaping mouth of the worm itself was like a mine shaft lined with crystal daggers. "It's the most fearsome creature on this miserable planet," Raban crowed, "and I've killed it." The soldiers peered, none of them wanting to approach closer than several meters. Kynes wondered how the Baron's nephew intended to haul this trophy back with him. With the Harkonnen penchant for extravagance, however, he assumed Raban would find a way. The planetologist turned to see that the exhausted Thekkar had plodded up beside them. His eyes held a silvery sheen, as if some inner fire blazed bright. Perhaps by coming so close to death and seeing the Freeman desert god laid low by Harkonnen explosives, his perspective on the world had changed. "Shai Hulud," he whispered. Then he turned to Kynes, as if sensing a kindred spirit. "This is an ancient one of the oldest of the worms." Kynes stepped forward to look at the encrusted skin, at its segments, and wondered how he might go about dissecting and analyzing the specimen. Certainly Raban couldn't object to that. If necessary, Kynes would invoke his assignment from the Emperor to make the man understand. But as he approached closer, intending to touch it, he saw that the skin of the old worm was shimmering, moving, shifting. The beast itself wasn't still alive. Its nerve functions had ceased even to twitch, and yet its outer layers trembled and shifted, as if melting. While Kynes stared in amazement, a rain of translucent cellular flaps dripped off the hulk of the old worm, like scales shed to the churned sand, where they vanished. "What's going on?" Raban cried, his face purpling. Before his eyes, the worm seemed to be evaporating. The skin sloughed off into tiny, flopping, amoeba-like patches that jiggled and then burrowed into the sand like molten solder. The ancient behemoth slumped into the desert. In the end, only skeletal, cartilaginous ribs and milky teeth were left. Then even these remains sank slowly, dissolving into mounds of loose gelatin covered by sand. The Harkonnen troops stepped back to a safer distance. To Kynes, it seemed as if he had seen 1,000 years of decay in only a few seconds. Accelerated entropy. The hungry desert seemed eager to swallow every shred of evidence, to conceal the fact that a human had defeated a sandworm. As Kynes thought about it, more in confusion and growing amazement than in dismay at losing all chance of dissecting the specimen, he wondered just how strange the life cycle of these magnificent beasts must be. He had so much to learn about Arrakis. Rabban stood, seething and furious, the muscles in his neck stretched taut like iron cables. "My trophy!" He whirled, clenched his fists, and struck Thekar full across the face, knocking him flat onto the sands. For a moment, Kynes thought the Baron's nephew might actually kill the desert man. But Rabban turned his rage and fury on the still-dissolving, shuddering heap of the sandworm sinking into the exploded sands. He screamed curses at it. Then, as Kynes watched, a determined look came into Rabban's cold, menacing eyes. His sunburned face flushed a deeper red. "When I return to Gedi Prime, I'll hunt something a lot more satisfying." Then, as if distracted from all thoughts of the sandworm, Rabban turned and stalked away. One observes the survivors and learns from them. Bene Gesserit teaching. Of all the fabled million worlds in the Imperium, young Duncan Idaho had never been anywhere but Gedi Prime, an oil-soaked, industry-covered planet filled with artificial constructions, square angles, metal, and smoke. The Harkonnens liked to keep their home that way. Duncan had known nothing else in his 8 years. Even the dark and dirt-stained alleys of his lost home would have been a welcome sight now, though. After months of imprisonment with the rest of his family, Duncan wondered if he would ever again go outside the huge enslavement city of Barony, or if he would live to see his 9th birthday, which shouldn't be too far off now. He wiped a hand through his curly black hair, felt the sweat there, and he kept running. The hunters were coming closer. Duncan was beneath the prison city now, with his pursuers behind him. He hunched down and rushed through the cramped maintenance tunnels, feeling like the spiny-backed rodent his mother had let him keep as a pet when he was 5. Ducking lower, he scuttled along in tiny crawl spaces, smelly air shafts, and power conduit tubes. The big adults with their padded armor could never follow him here. He scraped his elbow on the metal walls, worming his way into places no human should have been able to navigate. The boy vowed not to let the Harkonnens catch him, at least not today. He hated their games, refused to be anyone's pet or prey. Negotiating his way through the darkness by smell and instinct, he felt a stale breeze on his face and noted the direction of the air circulation. His ears recorded echoes as he moved, the sounds of other prisoner children running, also desperate. They were supposedly his teammates, but Duncan had learned through previous failures not to rely on people whose feral skills might not match his own. He swore he would get away from the hunters this time, but knew he would never be entirely free of them. In this controlled environment, the stalking teams would catch him again and run him through the paces over and over. They called it training. Training for what, he didn't know. Duncan's right side still ached from the last episode. As if he were a prized animal, his tormentors had put his injured body through a skin-knit machine and acucellular repair. His ribs still didn't quite feel right, but they had been getting better each day. Until now. With the locator beacon implanted in the meat of his shoulder, Duncan could never really escape from this slaveholding metropolis. Barony was a megalithic construction of plasteel and armor-plas, 950 stories tall and 45 kilometers long, with no ground-level openings whatsoever. He always found plenty of places to hide during the Harkonnen games, but never any freedom. The Harkonnens had many prisoners, and they had sadistic methods of making them cooperate. If Duncan won in this training hunt, if he eluded the searchers long enough, the keepers had promised that he and his family could return to their former lives. All the children had been promised the same thing. Trainees needed a goal, a prize to fight for. He ran by instinct through the secret passageways, trying to muffle his footfalls. Not far behind, he heard the blast and sizzle of a stun gun firing, a child's high-pitched squeal of pain, and then teeth-chattering spasms as another one of the young boys was brought to ground. If the searchers captured you, they hurt you, sometimes seriously and sometimes worse, depending upon the current supply of trainees. This was no child's game of hide-and-seek, at least not for the victims. Even at his age, Duncan already knew that life and death had a price. The Harkonnens didn't care how many small candidates suffered during the course of their training. This was how the Harkonnens played. Duncan understood cruel amusements. He had seen others do such things before, especially the children with whom he shared confinement, as they pulled the wings off insects or set tiny rodent babies on fire. The Harkonnens and their troops were like adult children, only with greater resources, greater imaginations, greater malice. Without making a sound, he found a narrow, rusted access ladder and scrambled up into the darkness, wasting no time on thought. Duncan had to do the unexpected, hide where they'd have trouble reaching him. The rungs, pitted and scarred with age, hurt his hands. This section of ancient barony still functioned. Power conduits and suspensor tubes shot through the main structure like wormholes. Straight, curved, hooking off at oblique angles. The place was one enormous obstacle course, where the Harkonnen troops could fire upon their prey without risking damage to more important structures. Above him in the main corridor, he heard booted feet running, filtered voices through helmet communicators, then a shout. A nearby pinging sound signaled that the guards had homed in on his locator implant. Hot, white laser gun fire blasted the ceiling over his head, melting through metal plates. Duncan let go of the ladder and allowed himself to drop, free fall. One armed guard peeled up the hot-edged floor plate and pointed down at him. The others fired their laser guns again, severing the struts so that the ladder fell in tandem with the small boy. He landed on the floor of a lower shaft, and the heavy ladder clattered on top of him. But Duncan didn't cry out in pain. That would only bring the pursuers closer. Though he had no real hope of eluding them for long because of the pulsing beacon in his shoulder. How could anyone but Harkonnens win this game? He pushed himself to his feet and ran with a new, frantic desire for freedom. To his dismay, the small tunnel ahead opened into a wider passage. Wider was bad. The bigger men could follow him there. He heard shouts behind, more running feet, gunfire, and then a gurgling scream. The pursuers were supposed to be using stun guns, but Duncan knew that this late in the day's hunt, most everyone else would have been captured, and the stakes were higher. The hunters didn't like to lose. Duncan had to survive. He had to be the best. If he died, he couldn't go back to see his mother again. But if he lived and defeated these bastards, then perhaps his family would get their freedom. Or as much freedom as Harkonnen civil service workers could ever have on Giri Prime. Duncan had seen other trainees who had defeated the pursuers before, and those children had disappeared afterward. If he could believe the announcements, the winners and their captive families had been set free from the hellhole of Barony. Duncan had no proof of this, though, and had plenty of reasons to question what the Harkonnens told him. But he wanted to believe them, could not give up hope. He didn't understand why his parents had been thrown into this prison. What had minor government office workers done to deserve such punishment? He remembered only that one day life had been normal and relatively happy. And the next, they were all here, enslaved. Now young Duncan was forced nearly every day to run and fight for his life, and for the future of his family. He was getting better at it. He remembered that last normal afternoon, out on the manicured lawn planted high up in one of the Harko City terraces, one of the rare balcony parks the Harkonnens allowed their subjects to have. The gardens and hedges were carefully fertilized and tended, because plants did not fare well in the residue-impregnated soil of a planet that had been too long abused. Duncan's parents and other family members had been playing frivolous lawn games, tossing self-motivated balls at targets on the grass, while internal, high-entropy devices made the balls bounce and ricochet randomly. The boy had noticed how different, how dry and structured the games of adults were, compared with the reckless romping he did with his friends. A young woman stood near him, watching the games. She had chocolate-colored hair, dusky skin, and high cheekbones, but her pinched expression and hard gaze detracted from what might have been remarkable beauty. He didn't know who she was, and understood only that her name was Janice Milam, and she worked with his parents somehow. As Duncan had watched the adult yard game, listening to the laughter, he smiled at the woman and observed, "They're practicing to be old men." It became apparent, though, that Janice had no real interest in him or his opinion, for she'd given him a sharp verbal brush-off. Under the hazy sunlight, Duncan had continued to watch the game, but with increasing curiosity about the stranger. He sensed tension in her. Janice, who didn't participate, frequently glanced over her shoulder, as if watching for something. Moments later, Harkonnen troops had come, grabbing Duncan's parents, himself, even his uncle and two cousins. He understood intuitively that Janice had been the cause of it all, for whatever reason. He'd never seen her again, and he and his family had been in prison for half a year now. Behind him, an overhead trap door opened with a hiss. Two blue-uniformed pursuers dropped through, pointed at him, and laughed in triumph. Weaving from side to side, Duncan dashed ahead. A lasergun blast ricocheted off the wall plates, leaving a lightning bolt scorch mark down the corridor. Duncan smelled the ozone from the singed metal. If even one of those bolts hit him, he'd be dead. He hated the way the hunters snickered, as if they were merely toying with him. A pair of pursuers charged out of a side passage only a meter in front of him, but Duncan moved too fast. They didn't recognize him or react quickly enough. He struck one stout man in the knee and knocked him sideways before dashing between the two at a full run. The stout man stumbled, then shouted as a laser bolt singed his armor, "Stop firing, you idiot! You'll hit one of us!" Duncan ran as he'd never run before, knowing his child's legs couldn't outrace adults conditioned for fighting. But he refused to give up. It wasn't in his blood. Ahead, where the corridor opened, he saw bright lights at an intersection of passageways. As he approached, he skidded to a stop, only to find that the cross passage was no tunnel at all, but a suspensor tube, a cylindrical shaft with a Holtzman field in the center. Levitating bullet trains shot down the tube without resistance, traveling from one end of the enormous prison city to the other. There were no doors, no open passageways. Duncan could run no farther. The men surged close behind him, extending their guns. If he surrendered, he wondered if they would still shoot him down. Probably, he thought, since I've got their adrenaline going. The suspensor field shimmered in the center of the horizontal shaft in front of him. He vaguely knew what it would do. He had only one place left to go, and he wasn't sure what would happen. But he knew he'd be punished, or most likely slaughtered, if the guards captured him. So, as they pressed closer, Duncan turned around and gazed into the suspensor field. Taking a deep breath for courage, he swung his short arms behind him and leaped out into the open, shimmering tube. His curly black hair rippled in the breeze as he plummeted. He shouted, the sound halfway between a despairing wail and a cry of glorious release. If he died here, at least he would be free. Then the Holtzman field wrapped around him and caught him with a jolt. Feeling as if his stomach had just lurched to the center of his chest, Duncan found himself adrift in an invisible net. He floated without falling, hanging in the neutral center of the field. This force held the bullet trains suspended as they careened through mammoth barony. It could certainly hold him. He saw the guards rushing to the edge of the platform, shouting at him in anger. One shook a fist. Two others pointed their guns. Duncan flailed in the field, trying to swim. Anything to move away. With a shout of alarm, a guard knocked the other's laser gun aside. Duncan had heard about the nightmarish effects of a laser gun beam crossing a Holtzman field. They produced an interacting destructive potential as deadly as forbidden atomics themselves. So the guards fired their stun weapons instead. Duncan writhed in the air. Though he could get no leverage, at least he made a moving target as he squirmed and spun. Stun blasts arced on either side of him, diverted into curving paths. Despite the confining embrace of the Holtzman field, he felt the air pressure change around him, sensed the currents of movement. He rotated himself, bobbing in the air, until he saw the oncoming lights of a bullet train. And he was at the center of the field. Duncan thrashed, desperate to move. He drifted toward the opposite edge of the levitation zone, away from the guards. They continued to fire, but the change in air pressure pushed their stun blasts even farther off the mark than before. He saw the uniformed men making adjustments. Below him were other doorways, ramps, and platforms that led into the bowels of barony. Maybe he could reach one, if he could just escape the confining field. Another stun blast tore past, and this time caught the edge of his back near his shoulder, numbing him, making the muscles and skin crawl with a sensation like 1,000 stinging insects. Duncan finally wrenched himself away from the field and dropped. Falling face down, he saw the platform just in time. He reached out with his good arm and snagged a railing. The bullet train screamed past, whistling as it displaced air, missing him by centimeters. He hadn't had time to pick up much momentum in his fall. Even so, the jarring stop nearly ripped his other arm out of its socket. Duncan scrambled up and ran into a tunnel, but found only a tiny alcove with metal walls. He could see no exit. The hatch was sealed and locked. He pounded on it, but couldn't go anywhere. Then the outer door clanged shut behind him, sealing him into a small armor-walled box. He was trapped. This time it was over. Moments later, the guards unsealed the rear hatch. Their stares, as pointed as their weapons, held a mixture of anger and admiration. Duncan waited with resignation for them to gun him down. Instead, the hunt captain smiled without humor and said, "Congratulations, boy. You made it." Exhausted and back in his cell, Duncan sat with his mother and father. They ate their daily meal of bland cereals, starch cakes, and protein chips. Nutritionally satisfying, yet almost maliciously made with either foul flavors or no taste whatsoever. So far, the boy hadn't been told more by his captors, just that he'd made it. That had to mean freedom. He could only hope. The family's cell was filthy. Though his parents tried to keep it clean, they had no brooms, mops, or soap, and very little water, which couldn't be wasted on mere sanitation. During the months of confinement, Duncan had undergone vigorous and violent training, while his family sat fearfully off stage, doing nothing with their days. All of them had been given numbers, slave cell addresses, and, with the exception of Duncan, nothing to do. No labor, no entertainment. They simply awaited any change in their sentence, and dreaded that such a change would someday come. Now, with excitement and pride, Duncan told his mother of his adventures, how he had outwitted the pursuers, how he had been resourceful enough to defeat even the best Harkonnen trackers. None of the other children had succeeded on this day, but Duncan was certain he'd done what was necessary to buy freedom. Any minute now they'd be released. He tried to imagine his family standing together again, free, outside, looking up into a clear starlit night. His father gazed proudly at the boy, but his mother found it difficult to believe that such a thing could possibly be true. She had good reason not to trust Harkonnen promises. Before long, the cell lights flickered, and the opaque door field became transparent, then opened. A group of blue-uniformed prison guards stood beside the smiling hunt captain who had chased him. Duncan's heart leaped. Are we going to be set free? He didn't like the hunt captain's smile, though. The uniformed men stepped aside in deference to a man with broad shoulders, thick lips, and big muscles. His face was sunburned and ruddy, as if he had spent a great deal of time far from gloomy Geedy Prime. Duncan's father sprang to his feet, then bowed clumsily. My Lord Rabban. Ignoring the parents, Rabban's eyes sought out only the round-faced young trainee. The captain of the hunt tells me you're the best boy, he said to Duncan. As he stepped into the cell, the guards hustled in behind him. Rabban grinned. You should have seen him in today's exercise, my lord, the hunt captain said. Never had a more resourceful pup. Rabban nodded. Number 11368, I've seen your records, watched hollows of your hunts. How are your injuries? Not too bad. You're young, so you'll heal quickly. His eyes hardened. Lots more fun left in you. Let's see how you do against me. He turned about. Come with me for the hunt, boy. Now. My name is Duncan Idaho, the boy responded in a defiant tone. I'm not a number. His voice was thin and high-pitched, but held a gruff bravery that shocked his parents. Surprised, the guards turned to stare at him. Duncan looked to his mother for support, as if hoping for some kind of challenge or reward. Instead, she tried to hush him. Rabban coolly snatched a laser gun from the guard standing next to him. Without the slightest pause, he fired a lethal blast into the chest of Duncan's father. The man slammed against the wall. Before his corpse could slide to the floor, Rabban shifted his weapon and incinerated the head of Duncan's mother. Duncan screamed. Both of his parents tumbled to the floor, lifeless mounds of blistering, burned flesh. Now you have no name, 11368, Rabban said. Come with me. The guards grabbed him, not even letting Duncan rush to his fallen parents, not even giving him time to cry. These men will have to prepare you before we can begin the next round of fun. I need a good hunt for a change. The guards dragged Duncan, kicking and screaming, out of the noisome cell. He felt dead inside, except for an icy flame of hatred that blossomed in his chest and burned away all vestiges of his childhood. The populace must think their ruler is a greater man than they, else why should they follow him? Above all, a leader must be a showman, giving his people the bread and circuses they require. Duke Paulus Atreides. The weeks of preparation for his sojourn on Ix passed in a blur, as Leto tried to drink up a year's worth of memories and store them, fixing all the images of his ancestral home in his mind. He would miss Caladan's moist, salty air, its fog-shrouded mornings, and the musical afternoon rainstorms. How could a stark, colorless machine planet compare with this? Of the many palaces and vacation villas on the water-rich planet, Castle Caladan, perched high on a cliff over the sea, was the true place where Leto belonged, the main seat of government. Some day, when he finally put on the ducal signet ring, he would be the 26th Duke Atreides to sit in the castle. His mother, Helena, spent much time fussing over him, seeing omens in many things, and quoting passages she considered important from the Orange Catholic Bible. She was distressed to be losing her son for a year, but would not countermand the old Duke's orders. Not in anyone's hearing, at least. Her expression was troubled, and Leto realized it especially alarmed her that Paulus had chosen to send him to Ix, of all places. "It's a festering hotbed of suspect technology," she said to him when her husband was gone, far out of earshot. "Are you sure you aren't just reacting because Ix is the main rival to House Ritchie's mother?" he asked. "I think not." Her long, slender fingers paused as they laced up an elegant collar on his shirt. "House Ritchie's relies on old, tried-and-true technology, established devices that fall safely within prescribed guidelines. No one questions Ritchiesian adherence to the strictures of the jihad." She looked at him, her dark eyes hard, then cracking with tears. She stroked his shoulder. From a recent spurt of growth, he was almost her height. Leto, I don't want you to lose your innocence there, or your soul," she told him. "There's too much at stake." Later in the dining hall, during a quiet family meal of fish stew and biscuits, Helena had once again begged the old Duke to send him somewhere else. Paulus merely laughed at her concerns, though, until finally her quiet but firm refusal to back down drove him to rage. "Dominic is my friend, and by God our son couldn't learn at the hands of a better man." Trying to concentrate on his own meal, yet disturbed over his mother's protestations, Leto had nonetheless stood by his father. "I want to go there, Mother," he said, gently resting his spoon beside his bowl. Then repeated the line she always told him. "It's for the best." During Leto's upbringing, Paulus had made many choices with which Helena disagreed. Putting the young man to work with villagers, taking him out to meet citizens face to face, letting him make friends with commoners, encouraging him to get his hands dirty. Leto could see the wisdom in this, since he would be Duke of these people some day. But Helena still objected on various grounds, often quoting passages from the Orange Catholic Bible to justify her opinions. His mother was not a patient woman and not warm to her only child, though she maintained a perfect front during important meetings and public events. She always fussed about her own appearance and often said she would never have any more children. Bringing up one son and running the ducal household already took up most of her valuable time, which could otherwise have been spent studying the Orange Catholic Bible and other religious texts. It was obvious that Helena had borne a son only out of duty to House Atreides, rather than out of any desire to nurture and raise a child. No wonder the old Duke sought out the companionship of other women who proved less prickly. Sometimes at night, behind the massive doors of Laird Ilacantique, Leto heard the loud, reverberating arguments of his father and mother. Lady Helena could disagree all she wanted about sending their son to Ix, but old Duke Paulus was House Atreides. His word was law, in the castle and on Caladan, no matter how much his distraught wife tried to sway his opinion. It's for the best. Leto knew that theirs had been an arranged marriage, a bargain struck among the houses of the Landsraad to fulfill the requirements of the important families. It had been a desperate action on the part of crumbling Richies, and House Atreides could always hope the former grandeur of the innovative technological house might rise again. In the meantime, the old Duke had received substantial concessions and rewards for taking in one of the many daughters of House Richies. A noble household has little room for the swooning and romanticism lesser peoples feel when hormones guide their actions, his mother had once said to him, explaining the politics of marriage. He knew such a fate undoubtedly lay in store for him as well. His father even agreed with her in this regard, and was more adamant about it than she. "What's the first rule of the house?" the old Duke would say, ad nauseam. And Leto would have to repeat it word for word. "Never marry for love, or it will bring our house down." At 14, Leto had never been in love himself, though he had certainly felt the fires of lust. His father encouraged him to dally with the village girls, to toy with anyone he found attractive, but never to promise anything. Leto doubted, given his position as heir apparent to House Atreides, that he would ever have much chance to fall in love, especially not with the woman he would eventually take as his wife. One morning, a week before Leto was scheduled to leave, his father clapped a hand on his shoulder and took him along as he went about his rounds to meet the people, making a point to greet even the servants. The Duke led a small honor guard into the seaside town below the castle, doing his own shopping, seeing his subjects, and being seen. Paulus often went on such outings with his son, and Leto always considered these to be wonderful times. Out under the pale blue sky, the old Duke laughed easily, beaming with infectious good nature. The people smiled when the hearty man walked among them. Leto and his father strolled together along the bazaar, past the stalls of vegetables and fresh fish, to inspect beautiful tapestries woven from beaten pongee fibers and fire threads. There, Paulus Atreides often found baubles or keepsakes for his wife, especially after they had quarreled, though the Duke didn't seem to understand Helena's interests enough to select anything appropriate for her. At an oyster stall, the old Duke suddenly paused and gazed up at the cloud-scudded sky, struck by what he considered a brilliant idea. He looked down at his son, and a broad grin split his bushy beard. "Ah, we need to send you off with an appropriate spectacle, lad. Make your leave-taking a memorable event for all of Caladan." Leto forced himself not to cringe. He had heard his father's crazy ideas before, and knew the old Duke would follow through regardless of common sense. "What do you have in mind, sir? What do I need to do?"
"Nothing, nothing. I shall announce a celebration in honor of my heir and son."
He grabbed Leto's hand and raised it up in the air, as if in a triumphant wave. Then his voice boomed out, subduing the crowds.
"We are going to have a bullfight, an old-fashioned extravaganza for the populace. It will be a day of celebration for Caladan, with hollow projections transmitted around the globe."
"With Seleucid bulls?" Leto asked, picturing in his mind the spine-backed beasts, their black heads studded with multiple horns, their eyes faceted. When he had been a younger boy, Leto had often gone into the stables to look at the monstrous animals. Stablemaster Iresk, one of his mother's old retainers from Richies, tended the bulls for Paulus's occasional spectacles.
Naturally, the old Duke said. And as usual, I'll fight them myself. He swept his arm out in a flourish, as if imagining a colorful cape there. These old bones are agile enough to dodge around a lumbering monster like that. I'll have Iresk prepare one. Or would you like to pick the beast yourself, lad? I thought you weren't going to do that anymore, Leto said. It's been almost a year since you... Wherever did you get that idea?
Your advisor, sir. It's too risky. Isn't that why others have been fighting the bulls in your place?
The old man laughed. What a foolish notion! I've been out of the ring for only one reason. The bulls went downhill for a while. Some genetic imbalance that made them unworthy. That's changed, though, and new bulls are being brought in now, tougher than ever. Iresk says they're ready to fight, and so am I.
He put his arm around Leto's narrow shoulders.
What better occasion for a corrida de toros than the leave-taking of my son? You'll attend this bullfight. You're first. Your mother can't say you're too young anymore.
Leto nodded reluctantly. His father would never be swayed once his mind was made up. At least Paulus had the training and would wear a personal shield. Using personal shields, Leto himself had fought human opponents, aware of a shield's advantages and limitations. A shield could block projectile fire and fast-moving weapons of death, but any blade traveling below the threshold speed could pass through to the unprotected flesh beneath. A rampaging Seleucid bull, with its sharp horns, might well move slowly enough to pierce even the most finely tuned shield. He swallowed hard, wondering about the new enhanced bulls. The old one, stablemaster Iresk had shown him, seemed dangerous enough. They'd killed three matadors that Leto could remember. Consumed by his fresh idea, Duke Paulus made the announcement at the bazaar, over the public address system implanted in booths and stalls. Upon hearing this, people in the marketplace cheered and their eyes glittered. They laughed, partly in anticipation of the performance itself, and also because of the declared day of rest and celebration. Leto's mother wouldn't like this at all, he knew. Paulus in the fight, and Leto in attendance. But Leto also understood that as soon as Helena began to object, the old Duke would be more determined than ever. The bowl of the Plaza de Toros sprawled under the noonday sun. The stands spread out in an immense broad grid, so filled with people that in the farthest reaches they looked like tiny colored pixels. The Duke had never charged any fee to witness his performances. He was too proud of them, enjoyed showing off too much. Enormous green and black banners flapped in the breeze, while fanfare blasted from speakers. Pillars emblazoned with Atreides' hawk crests sparkled with emblems that had been newly polished and painted for the event. Thousands of floral bouquets harvested from the fields and lowlands had been placed about the bullring, an unsubtle hint that the Duke liked the people to strew the ground with blossoms each time he dispatched a bull. Below, in the preparation chambers at ground level, Paulus girded up before the fight. Leto stood with him behind a barricade, listening to the impatient crowd.